the toad. Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me up, be the biggest little flirt. Well, I might.
Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
And welcome to the Shame Free Zone. This is your host, Veronica Monet. Tonight, my guest is Francisco. He joins us from Miami, and he's been on the show before. He's a college student and has been talking to me about some of his dating dilemmas. Tonight, we're going to take a little more of a cerebral approach to this whole thing around dating and gender and sex. Hi, Francisco. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm looking forward to our conversation. We always go in some very intriguing directions. So why not just launch right into it? First of all, how's the dating life been going? And you have any good news to share with us?
Well, I think I've gotten a lot more just peace of mind more than anything else. I kind of felt that for a long time I've been running away from a lot of insecurities that I thought I really didn't have, but I kind of became more aware of this recently in the kind of a recent kind of dating situation kind of put myself in. I really was enjoying the dating with her, but it's a large kind of fiasco kind of happened when she was still kind of hung up with an ex-boyfriend of hers. But it kind of just gave me peace of mind because really it kind of just reassured a little more confidence in myself, but also just realizing this position I am and just kind of more just waiting on the situation of a relationship that would be more appeasing to me. So in that sense that I have a little more peace of mind. That's something I've drained myself focus-wise, like I kind of was particularly a while ago. Now I'm kind of more just focusing on my goals and I'm still looking around and keeping my eyes open and looking for someone that I can date. And so hopefully something kind of turns around all right and I meet the right person. But like anything else, it's always it's a good thing, and I'm seeing it as a positive.
You definitely sound more confident. Absolutely, sound more confident. I love that. I mean, that's the whole thing. Is when we're kind of got that desperate grasping, I need somebody to fix me kind of energy, we tend to drive people away. So I think it's fabulous to focus on yourself and your life and what it is you want to do. And eventually, you are definitely going to, find yourself in the company of people who are attracted to that, attracted to your intelligence and your confidence. I think confidence is the sexiest thing going. That's why oftentimes those bad boys, they win because they're so confident. It's not necessarily because women want to spend time with bad boys. I mean, there may be a little of that too, but a lot of it's just the confidence thing. And I think if a woman can find a man who's confident, and a good guy, that she's probably going to choose that. You know what I mean?
Oh, of course. I think, like you were saying, I think, when you're pointing out the dog whispers, it's calm and assertive, and it works with dogs, but I'm not insinuating anyone's a dog, but it's that same kind of personality and that energy you put out is what people gravitate to. Yeah, there is a very physical attraction just by appearance, but like you're saying, it's more of a personal confidence more than anything else, and being assertive with that. So like, I think before I was kind of kind of a longing to really be with something, and I was just kind of just overthinking too much and kind of looking too much inward as far as what it's causing me not being able to find someone that is attracted to me. And in reality, the fact it was because I had a lack of confidence. And I had a confidence in myself that I enjoyed who I was, but I couldn't really portray that outward and felt the confidence that other women would like that. So
right.
I'm taking my time with that, though.
That's fabulous. And I think the whole thing about, you know, feeling like we have to have somebody too, and you know, we kind of tend to create the things we focus on. So if we're really focused on, well, nobody likes me, nobody likes me, and guess what? You're right. And then if you focus on, hey, I'm great and I'm fine, I'm comfortable just the way I am, and some people like me, some people don't like me, it doesn't really matter that much to me. You know, I'm having a good life and look forward to sharing it with the people who are right for me. That kind of energy tends to draw something else in, and usually it's something that's more pleasing and creates a little more happiness. So. Yeah.
So yeah, just since I had a little more less dilemma in my life as far as relationship wise, I wanted to go ahead and ask some more kind of broad questions on and sexualities and different things as far as other questions and just normal general.
Yeah, please do.
I think I came across an article today that I thought was kind of interesting, and it brought up I think a lot of different quick questions on prostitution and the situation. I came across that Natalie Dyland. It was part of mainstream media for a while, but I didn't come across it. That she put her virginity up for sale, and is that right now at $3.8 million?
Right.
I know that you're an advocate for decriminalizing prostitution, but does this kind of raise a little bit of red flags to you and the possibilities of problems with this? And if there's a growing trend of women trying to, young women especially, selling their virginity, is this a bad trend?
Well, I'd say bad, not necessarily a word I ascribe to. Good, bad. I like to think about, you know, are things functional or dysfunctional? Do things create positive outcomes or maybe, you know, negative outcomes? And because I don't really ascribe to the whole moral judgment thing so much as I do, you know, what's constructive and what's destructive. And a lot of that, you know, as far as the answer, I can't say for Natalie exactly what's going on with her and whether this is a positive or a negative for her, because I don't know her personally and I don't know her situation personally. Do some flags come up? Yeah, some flags come up a little bit because of the fact that, it sounds a little bit like she's kind of just making, well, okay, here's one of the things that comes up for me. As a former high-end escort, I wouldn't want to just give myself to the highest bidder. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that might sound really strange for a former prostitute, but the fact of the matter is that most sex workers don't sell themselves, first of all, and second of all, they certainly don't sell their services to the highest bidder. They position themselves in the market like any good business person does to, try to get the best price possible. But you balance that with whether or not you are safe, whether or not these clients are desirable people that you want to spend time with. So, feels a little less empowered to me than somebody who's actually in the business of escorting, because a person who's in the escorting business is looking to do this over and over again. They put some safeguards in place, such as how to screen, how to maybe have a backup that you would call to let them know where you're going to be. And also how to distinguish between good clients and bad clients. That's maybe the only time I can use those two words. But clients that are safe and respectful and are going to pay, and clients who may be into rip-off scams or violence or just being plain disrespectful. I mean, you know, you don't have to be a bad person or, you know, like morally corrupt to have maybe an unpleasant personality, an attitude that's degrading towards your provider. Most escorts are pretty careful not to spend time with people like that. So we've got a phone. call from Chris in San Francisco on line one. Chris, come on in. What do you got for us?
How are you?
Hi.
How's it going?
Well, we're going good. What's your question or comment for us?
I'm not sure what your topic is tonight, but I'm calling I think you and I talked a little bit about this. And for me, I'm going through midlife crisis right now. I'm in my late 40s. I had a job for 17 years. I lost it. My 401k plan, gone. Everything is gone. Everything, you know, I thought I was working towards is either gone or it was a big disappointment. I don't want to blame, I am married, and I don't want to blame anything on her, but it's difficult being in this marriage. So I'm kind of like not grounded and actually using providers as often as I can. It is a high. It does make me feel like I'm young. It makes me feel like I'm virile. But then I come home, I'm alone by myself, or I'm taking care of the kids like I am now.
Right.
I don't know who I am. You know, I'm not sure who I am anymore. I don't drink. I don't do drugs. I don't hang out with people that are, you know, partiers and whatnot. It's kind of lonely. So, I mean, what do you do? I've tried like psychotherapy, various different therapies, 12-step programs, total number of programs. I'm just not sure what to do anymore. I can't let go of the providers. Yeah.
Okay. I hear you can't let go of the providers. And here's the thing. Sex should be a positive thing that is building into your life. So it shouldn't be taking something away from your life. So if you found that a certain activity is causing you to feel empty, lonely, or like you don't know who you are anymore, then whatever that behavior is, it starts to sound like it might have some addictive qualities to it, because we can do anything. We can eat, you know, have sex. These are natural, normal, wonderful things that we should be doing, but we can use them addictively to the point to where we'll find ourselves feeling adrift and lost. And I don't know if that's your situation, but that's the first thing that comes up for me, is that you might want to look into that. And I'm wondering,
right.
I'm wondering if you've tried maybe some 12-step recovery around like sex and love addiction. Have you ever thought about that?
I've actually done that. And it was difficult for me to be in the room with some good-looking women. And I would share that, and afterwards I would just leave because it was really difficult.
Yeah, especially when you know they're sex addicts, huh?
Got going to an AA meeting, and I'm starting to crave a drink. But yes, no, I have done that. You know, I don't even know. The addictive stuff, yeah, that's going to be an issue. But I'm thinking about my life now. You know, I'm almost 50. And I'm like, oh, my God, what happened?
Well, your life in general?
Yeah, I mean, you know, with everything. I mean, my sex life with the wife, it used to be awesome. Multi-orgasmic. I mean, she could go on and on. I was just so happy. But, you know, it's not happening anymore. We sleep in different rooms.
Right.
You know, there are some things I think. Go ahead.
These things don't happen overnight. It's not like you just wake up and all of a sudden your marriage has fallen apart and you're having sex with providers. It's a gradual thing, and this is one of the reasons that, you know, when I'm working with couples, I try to teach them to look for the more subtle signs that the relationship is starting to erode. And one of the first subtle signs is when you tell yourself it's not worth a fight. And usually what that means is that you've like hit an impasse. Like, we've talked about this over and over and over again, and every time we go to talk about it, we cannot have a meeting of the minds. Neither one of us ever feels good after the conversation, and so we just basically go to our corners and give up. And at that moment, when you make that decision that it's not worth having the fight, you basically have sacrificed your passion. And your sex life will die. It will absolutely die. Now, okay, I'll say there's always an exception out there. There's some people who don't talk to each other and never have, and they still have great sex. But for the vast majority of us, we're not going to have good sex unless we learn how to communicate with each other.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
And I do own up to... Go ahead.
Well, it becomes imperative that both people are committed enough to go get help. You can't do this stuff alone. Well, our parents, for the most part, have not modeled this kind of behavior. So
right, exactly.
You've got to find a coach or a class or a workshop or a therapist. And that's what, you know, both couples actually have to be able to sit down and agree. What treatment modality do we want to pursue? Who do we like? Who are we going to see? And if you can't get a commitment out of your spouse to do something long term, try to get them to even just take a workshop with you or you know, have one appointment so that you can start gathering some tools. And if they refuse that, try a self-help book. There's great books out there. I really love one by Harville Hendricks called Getting the Love You Want.
Getting the Love You Want by who?
Getting the Love You Want. It's a book by Harville Hendricks.
Okay.
And, you know, a book is not going to solve your relationship. We're just trying to create
exactly
a little door here, a little door where you guys can start to have a conversation about maybe going and getting help. Because, you know, if you can't have the conversation, then you're not going to create connection. And if you don't have connection, you're not going to have compassion. And if you don't have compassion, you're not going to have passion.
Exactly.
These things all lead into each other.
My kid's crying in the other room.
It's okay, Chris.
I actually have to
get back to my guest, but I really appreciate your phone call, and I hope you'll call in maybe even next week.
I will. I'll keep it.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay, take
all right.
Care.
Blessings.
Bye.
Okay, bye. Francisco, are you still on the line?
Yes, I'm still here.
Yeah. Well, this is a live call-in show, and for any of our listeners who aren't aware of that, I just want to remind you, you can call toll-free here at 888-228-4494. You can also call direct at 415-287-3601, or you can Skype us at BBS Radio. You can also Twitter me at Veronica Monet. Now, back to your question, Francisco, about, like, is it the... Are we hitting some kind of a doomsday milestone here with girls auctioning off their virginity?
I won't see the actual process of prostituting as bad. I understand all your arguments, and I think those are all valid arguments. When women are in that profession, you begin to learn how to really act accordingly to your best safety, and you know all the warnings, most of the warning signs, and you can protect yourself.
The point I'm trying to make here is that it's a job. So anytime a novice, it's just like any other job out there. If somebody tried to run a radio station without any training, or somebody, you know, wants to go build a house without any education on how to, you know, be a contractor or construction, it's not going to turn out very well.
Right. It just seems that if there were a situation where decriminalization of prostitution were possible and forthcoming, it seems that women to sell up to virginity is in a very precarious situation, because they really essentially do not know what they're getting themselves into, and it leaves a recipe for disaster. But on the twofold, what kind of profile of men are paying top money for, not for an escort or prostitute, it's for virginity, which is something, I think, something entirely different. What kind of men are really going out of the way to do these things?
I personally, as an escort, wouldn't want to see anybody like that. Of course, I haven't been a virgin for a long time, so not even an issue. But here's what comes up for me is that either this person may think that they have got some I don't know, like, if this is going to make it, the sex safer, they're not going to have to use a condom. That's the first flag that comes up for me. And hold on, Francisco, with that thought. We've got another caller here. This is Steve from Michigan. Steve, are you there?
I am here, and you've been patient with me, asking me to call into your show, and I kind of missed your time a few times, but here I am.
Well, welcome. I'm really glad you made it. Thanks, Steve.
You're welcome. And I'm going to go back to a question I asked you a while back via email, and you asked me to call in. I was watching something that involved auctioning a woman off into slavery. That it was the movie Taken.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that they did was the auctioneer states that the person they're auctioning off is certified pure. Well, I know that it's possible for a woman who was very physically active to have her the hymen broken just from her physical activity, even if she's never had sex.
Right.
Now, I was wondering if the opposite is true, that a woman might have sex and not have her hymen broken.
Well, you know what? There's pretty much any instance you can possibly think. I have met women who've gotten pregnant while they were on birth control pills. And have I heard of instances where somebody could actually insert something? I'll give you, for instance, it's possible, not real likely, but it is possible that you could insert a tampon into a virginal, vagina and not break the hymen, because there's the hymen has a small hole in it to allow the blood to pass through. So it's possible, not necessarily likely, but I mean, let's face it, you know, I could tell you just from, I've met a lot of penises, and some of them aren't much bigger than a tampon. So it's possible. It's possible. Not likely, and I mean, if you've got a huge member and you're trying to insert that, then you're probably going to break the hymen. But it would be possible if you were really small, you know, and you didn't move around a lot. Like I said, it's possible to get a tampon up there without busting the hymen. And you know, obviously there's so many other sex acts that one can commit. And I can tell you one thing that's real popular now with women who are taking these abstinence oaths, you know, they're going to be virgins when they get married. They're actually having anal sex. So, and that's a more dangerous sex act when it comes to spreading HIV or any mm-hmm. kind of sexually transmitted diseases, because every time you have anal sex, you are going to create tears in the rectum. It absolutely, positively will happen every time. Even if you don't see any blood, you're still going to tear the rectum. It's just not really constructed for penetration. So no matter how much lube you use, and no matter how much you enjoy it, and no matter whether you see blood or not, you're going to create little tears in the rectum, and this creates a wonderful vehicle for transmitting anything. It's pretty much akin to inserting the virus or the bacteria directly into your bloodstream.
Wow.
So, with that in mind, some virgins, so, you know, quote-unquote technical virgins, they haven't had vaginal sex, so they still have an intact hymen, could be carrying a lot of sexually transmitted disease just because they're doing it anally instead. It depends. I mean, you can have anal sex safely. You absolutely can. But you need to be educated to it, and you know, the whole problem is that we're talking about people who think they're virgins because they're having anal sex. It's not a terribly educated stance to be coming from.
Yeah, that sounds kind of odd to me too. But, I kind of want to apologize to you because I'm not calling with my personal problems. But I guess I kind of need to loosen up to that a little bit. I'm not ready for that. So I thought, well, you know, this would be sort of. This is sort of just something I was curious about, and might make a good
first question. Well, that's no apology necessary at all, Steve. I mean, this is interesting conversation. I think I welcome anybody who wants to call with, you know, questions about stuff they've seen in the news or read in the paper or anything like that, or just, you know, stuff that they maybe were a little too shy to ask their doctor. Here's the sad thing about most of our medical doctors. They have about one-fifth the academic background in sex that I have, and then, of course, not even anything near the hands-on experience that I have, but I'm just getting certified as a sexologist. I have like 5 times as much academic information about sex as most medical doctors, which is a really sad state of affairs for the medical profession. But most of medical doctors haven't actually learned how to have a conversation about sex without getting embarrassed either. So these are the kind of questions that I want to help people with. So, no apology necessary.
It's interesting that attitude that the person you're talking about having, in that they, you know, they could have anal sex and they would still be a virgin. That seems like kind of odd. But I met someone once who had been in prison, and he talked about the relief provided by the homosexuals, and it struck me that his perspective was that the people being penetrated were homosexuals, but his doing the penetrating, it was not a homosexual act, and I thought that was
right.
I thought that was a little strange, kind of an attitude, but
it's again a very unenlightened, uneducated stance in a lot of ways, because he's taking this attitude that the person that receives penetration is somehow or another beneath or less than the person who actually penetrates, and so it's coming from a pretty homophobic, sexist stance. You know, the same attitude that's going to be shown towards the female. You know, somehow she's less than him because he's penetrating her. However, I do want to say that I think everybody should be able to self-describe, and there's plenty of people who've had homosexual experiences who don't identify as being homosexual, as long as that's not a cover for being a homophobe and committing hate crimes, then I think people should be allowed to make that call themselves. Not everybody wants to identify as being gay just because they've had gay experiences. And frankly, there are gay people who have heterosexual experiences and don't want to be identified as bisexual. So, and, you know, that's up to them. Gender identity is real complex, and so sometimes you can be really identified with a heterosexual ideology or a gay lifestyle, and yet sometimes your sexual behavior doesn't necessarily coincide with that. So,
I get that. It's just that you know, even if you're a heterosexual person having a gay experience, it's still a gay experience. It's not, to me, he seemed kind of further dissociated from what he was experiencing than that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's a big flag for somebody who's probably got a certain amount of self-hatred. But I do try to be cautious about that and take it on an individual basis, you know, because everybody has a little different stance that they're coming from. Anyway, do you want to hold the line while I continue to have a conversation with Francisco, or are you calling next week
sure,
with more questions,
that,
or did you have another question now? Do you
want
to hold the line?
I was just saying, sure, that would be great.
Okay, hold the line. And Francisco, are you still with me?
I'm still here.
Awesome. So now we got Michigan, Miami, and Lake Tahoe tied in. Isn't modern technology wonderful?
Sure. It's interesting on something somewhat related to what he was mentioning. I had this kind of a notion. It's kind of a cliche, I think, and something that a lot of men kind of think about, that there are actually no variants as far as men's sexuality, that there's only like an on and off switch. Men can only be either gay or either only can be straight. That there really is no intermediate zone that there is within the female community. And I think that simply is kind of a wrong position, that because it seems like it's a kind of an on and off switch, it's because that there's more, I think, maybe social pressure on society toward or shuns against more gay men than they do gay women. So it seems like more people, the only people that really kind of come up with their sexuality as being or supporting that their gay side is when they're more towards the spectrum of only being sexually attracted to gay. Is that a kind of a right analysis in your perspective, or maybe not?
Well, you know, like I said, it's really up to the individual. There are, I certainly have known, you know, people who identify as gay who have sex with the opposite gender pretty frequently, and vice versa. I have seen, you know, people who are identified as heterosexual who have had a lot of homosexual experiences. And in the past, I used to feel like that was really disingenuous, and that's because I'm bisexual. So I'm like, come on, you guys need to come out of the closet. You're obviously bisexual. Get over it. But you know, with experience and with time, I meet a lot of people and become more involved in those communities and in a lot of different communities, you know, polyamorous and monogamous and heterosexual and gay and bisexual and transgender. And after a while, I start to realize that it's just so important that people are allowed to call themselves whatever they want to call themselves, that only you really know what label, if you want to have a label, fits you. And there's actually another movement out there from some people who say, I don't want your labels. I don't want you calling me gay or straight or bisexual. For a while, they were referring to that as fluid. I am fluid, thank you very much. Meaning, don't fence me in and don't put me in a box. And I was part of the bisexual movement in San Francisco in the 90s. It was very, very important to me that people own up to being bisexual so that we could further our movement. And I was tired of people, you know, trying to pick a side. Come on, you know, you don't have to be gay or straight. You could be bisexual. Mm-hmm. I think as movements go, you know, in time we want to be able to get to the point where we're just people. So we don't have to have a label. And I totally, you know, having been a political activist most of my life, I get that those labels are really important to defend sometimes because we don't want to be invisible and, you know, that's a huge thing, to not be invisible. But as time goes on and we start getting rights for people and we've created, you know, penalties for hate crimes, I don't really think we're there yet. But I could see that that would be a future trend where we don't have to worry about what we call ourselves. We're just human beings being human beings. But that would be fitting into our bonobo world, wouldn't it, where everybody can have sex with anybody and we don't have to label ourselves.
Right. It just seems that in human nature, it just seems like group identity is so strong. You mean, there's been so much research on so many different fields from political science and anthropology that people identify themselves accordingly through so many different ways. So it seems like even though we want to rid ourselves from stigmatizing our first sexuality, I think it's a trend that we're going to have for a while. At least the bad connotations will be removed, but the actual group identity associated with these things, I think the most likely will kind of persist.
Yeah, true. Steve, are you there?
I'm here.
Yeah, Steve, what do you think about this discussion? What do you think about people who don't want to own up to being gay, or do you look at it that way? Do you think maybe we can allow people to call themselves whatever they want, regardless of who they're having sex with?
Well, I don't know. I guess I'm sort of two minds, because I sort of like the idea of you know, you can have sex with whoever you want, and who cares what they call it or whatever. But I also find it, you know, like in the case of my friend who, well, here's one for you. There are homophobic men who beat up gay men and rape them orally because they're gay, and yet they don't, somehow they don't see what they're doing as a homosexual act.
Yeah.
Doesn't that kind of sound a little weird?
Well, it's weird. It's horrific. It's also a lot of time and a lot of internalized homophobia. In other words, you know, some of the people who commit the most horrific hate crimes towards gay, lesbian, and transgender people are, in fact, themselves gay, lesbian, or transgender. Or and to the sense of being in denial about that, like, it's like I am the most terrified of the thing that lives inside of me that I don't want to look at. And so the easiest thing that I can do is to persecute you, to hurt you. And that's how I deal with my own, you know, conflicts about who I am. If I can do that to you, then I'm not really to blame. And I mean, I have personal experience with this in my family. It's like, you know, one of my uncles raped a cousin. And as far as he's concerned, he's in good standing because he's been forgiven by Jesus and he's going to go to heaven. But he condemns the cousin who grew up and became gay and says, calls him up to tell him he's going to go to hell.
Wow.
So, yeah, but I mean, that's what that looks like. It's like, I'm not comfortable with my own sexuality, and so I'm going to tell you, you're going to hell. And I think, what was the name of it? Ted Haggard, was that his name? That the minister who was, he was like advising George Bush when George Bush was in office. Virulently opposed to homosexuality, preaching about its evils to the whole world, and then got caught seeing male prostitutes. So it's for me, the more homophobic you are, the more I'm convinced you're probably gay. that's how I see it. I'm sure there's lots of people who would disagree with that, but I think homophobia is certainly one of those flags for being a closeted gay person.
Now, here's something. I have a friend. She's a PhD psychologist, and she was married to a man and had children, and now she prefers women. And I would the way I would look at it at her is, I'm aware that there are a lot of I think especially lesbians more than gay men, but there are a lot of folks who give heterosexuality a try in kind of while they're trying to figure themselves out or whatever, and then later decide that they're gay. And from my perspective, that's kind of where she's at or whatever. But okay. But she says that she's bi, and she says that basically we are all bi. But on the other hand, you know, she's very clear about the fact that she's given up on men and would never be with a man again.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's her journey. And I'm not sure what I see as a question there.
I guess I was just pointing it out as an example of kind of what we're talking about. But I don't find her position in kind of as strange as some of the others we were talking about, but it's kind of interesting.
Well, people, you know, sexuality is kind of, sometimes, like, I've been bisexual all my life, but, you know, sometimes I'm more attracted and interested in men, and sometimes I've been more interested in women, and I'm never really, like, just set on one particular formula, if you will, like, I like men and women equally. It's fluctuated over the years. It's totally fluctuated. I kind of think, I don't know. It's certainly normal and natural for me and lots of other people that I know that they don't necessarily always feel the same way. Now, I know for some people that the truth for them is that I've been in denial all these years and I finally know the truth about myself. But sometimes I think when we get away from all the politicizing around this and we can finally just be free to be who we are, we may find that we go through stages, and you know, we're maybe more heterosexual at certain parts of our life and more gay at other times of our life, and does it really matter?
Sure.
So, Steve, I'm coming up towards the end of the program here, and I want to make sure that Francisco gets to ask a couple more questions that he had for tonight.
Okay.
Will you do me the honor of calling me back next week?
Sure.
I'd love that. Love to have you back on the show.
Okay.
Okay. All right. And take care. Thanks for calling from Michigan. That's Steve from Michigan. And Francisco, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. Yeah. And we've got
yeah,
about
what am I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just had probably one more couple last questions on, we just kind of focused on the email on about the concept of conversion. What I took from it is that when a person actually gets pleasure when their lover has a relationship with another, that essentially people kind of see it as a polar opposite to jealousy, but from what I've seen from people that actually engage in it, that it's actually more like the same feeling but wrapped around it with negative feelings. So actually within the feeling of jealousy, there's actually a feeling of pleasure, but kind of through socialization of society, we've progressed into a painful experience. So my question would be is whether or not naturally as humans, do we express jealousy first and that we can desocialize it and develop it into conversion? Or does compersion come first and we essentially socialize jealousy over it? I can only assume that your stance from your lecture that you're stressing of us being more genetically close to the bonobo, that assuming that compersion would naturally arise first, but can we be for certain of this?
Well, you know, we're all different. Again, and I think it's real important that we remember that the individual has their own reality. Now, I think if you look at the development of the human being, a lot of times you're going to find that the first thing that happens when you're a little kid is that you are feeling jealous and possessive of your toys. I can remember being about 4 years old, and they put a cousin in the car with me, and I had all these toys scattered around in the back of the car where I was playing, and my cousin, I was more like two. I was so young, I think I was still in diapers. And I can remember trying to grab all the toys so that my cousin couldn't touch any of them. And I was so little, I couldn't hold all the toys at once. So they kept slipping away, and my cousin kept trying to touch the ones that I couldn't hold. So it was pretty comical, but I remember thinking, boy, I was really being a selfish little kid. And I'm sure that's because some adult, one of my parents probably said, hey, share your toys. And I don't think that that's something that we're born with, is the idea of sharing. I think that it's something we're socialized to do. You know, you mentioned the bonobos. They have a very structured social, framework in which their young are born into. And I think that as probably we'll find out that they don't just have this genetic predisposition. I think it's a culture. I mean, the point that I try to make really about chimpanzees, bonobos, and humans is that we have so much of the same genetic material, all three of us. And you look at the chimpanzee and the human, which has taken this monotheistic, patriarchal, warlike stance where sex is a rare commodity and, you know, murder and infanticide and rape and war are commonplace. And then you look at the bonobo, which has the same genetic makeup, and it is enjoying polyamory and, you know, bisexuality and promiscuity and no violence. Mm-hmm. So my point is, about that is that we can choose whether or not we want to have a culture that's warlike like the chimpanzees or a culture that's peaceful like the bonobos, because we are almost identical genetically. And I think that's a cultural thing, not a genetic thing. I think personally that most of us are born feeling selfish and jealous and just because of the fact of being around little kids, that's usually something you have to teach them away from. You have to teach them how to share. You have to teach them how not to hit. You have to teach them, you know, how to talk instead of throw a temper tantrum. Those things don't usually just come natural. So parenting and culture, that becomes a job that we as adults get to pass on, this more peaceful, more adapted, more functional behavior that maybe isn't what, you know, what we're just born with.
You're mentioning the polyamory like societies that this is probably better for mental health and that living more of the kind of chimpanzee social structure. I was looking at just some rough statistics of people that engage in societies or communities of polyamory kind of mentality, and it showed that it was kind of disproportionately older, that the average median was, like, I think 39 or something like that. Why do you think is this? Why do you think that that's not a representation of a younger crowd? It seems like the newer generation being born out of the baby boomer generation, which was the biggest sexual movement in the United States, that the next generation would push more towards the envelope and maybe going into this. Why it kind of seems like
stagnated
in a way.
Let's give a nod to the young people who are polyamorous. Like, there's lots of young people in their 20s that are being poly over at One Taste in San Francisco and in New York. That's a group living situation that's very poly and very open and very progressive and very young. Granted, however, their founder is in her 40s. So, yes, I think one of the reasons that this comes out of the older generation could be because, you know, some of them actually came out of the 60s when, incidentally, they refer to the bonobos as the hippie monkeys because of the fact that they embrace that whole make love not war thing. So we've seen a lot of backlash from subsequent generations where, you know, they kind of a return to materialism and away from politics, and now I think we're again seeing, you know, young people getting involved in politics, certainly around the Obama election that was the case. And I think there's a chance that we may actually see more of a sex-positive approach now that we've got, I think, a more sex-positive administration. I certainly hope so, but, it remains to be seen. It's an unknown quantity at this point. We've had 8 years of a lot of sexual repression and oppression. Bush had constructed these anti-prostitution pledges that, were not just affecting money that was going overseas, but also affecting organizations here in the United States. And then we had the whole abstinence thing where we were not allowed to teach children even how to use a condom or that there was such a thing as birth control. We've been telling kids now for 8 years that condoms don't prevent sexually transmitted diseases and that the best solution to teen pregnancy is abstinence, which, of course, has just led to a skyrocketing teen pregnancy rate in the United States because abstinence leads to teen pregnancy. What you wind up with is people who are uninformed about how to prevent pregnancy, who are still driven by this overwhelming toxic level of hormones when you're in your teens, which is going to lead inevitably to sex, unprotected sex. So basically, we can thank the whole abstinence movement for an off-the-chart teen pregnancy now. But that comes with it some pretty, you know, shame-based attitudes towards sex that we are now going to have to deal with, you know, the younger generation that's coming up.
How do we re-educate them? How do we tell them, yeah, condoms do work, and you don't have to consider yourself a bad person if you happen to avail yourself of birth control methods? It's kind of like a whole re-education process that we're now going to have to engage in.
Yeah, and I think one of your statements you said was sex without shame. I think it's a very powerful message, because ever since I've kind of read that, and encounter more women and discuss with them, you can see how much shame they carry because of sex. I mean, I think this last girl I was talking to, she confided in me that she had a one-night stand of someone I had known, acquaintance, and she had so much shame and pent up remorse and regret from the situation, and it was just, you can tell that this was just simply a socialized feeling from shame that she carried through sex, and it is sad. Hopefully that we can, as a society, seems like we're going in the right direction, but we still live in a very conservative kind of mentality, and it's very harmful to us.
This country, particularly the United States, has just been very difficult for us to get past our puritanical roots. It really has. You know, we of all the countries, progressive Western nations, you know, on the planet, we have some of the most arcane attitudes towards sex. It's amazing. I mean, in some European television stations, you routinely see nudity, and people talk about sex all the time. But you're not going to see, they're going to see it here, not in this country, because, I don't think it's any coincidence that we also happen to be one of the most violent Western countries.
A lot of that has to do with you make the association to violence, war, and sex, that there is not direct correlation, but a very strong association. I don't think it's a very strong indicator that after World War II and this backlash to war, and this anti-feeling against the remorse of war led to the strongest liberalization forces in Europe, which led to the collapse of the overseas empire, but also in the same sense, it led to a very liberal approach towards sex, which allowed them to be the society they are today, which allows for more sexual freedom. But here in the United States, though we engaged in World War II, we really did not have a feel the same kind of atrocities that really took place there. So until we can kind of get that backlash to war or kind of calamity that can make us less materialistic, we'll have the kind of drive towards that. And that's kind of my perception of that association.
Well, I think that's very interesting food for thought. I certainly hope that the United States doesn't have to experience firsthand those kind of tragedies, although it seems that, you know, they've actually done studies. Political leaders who have never seen combat are usually the ones who are most likely to declare war, because the generals, the guys that have actually been out there fighting in the trenches with their men, will be the most hesitant to declare war, because they've seen it. They've seen it firsthand, and they know just how hideous it is.
With torture as well, you can see that with our last president, he's been very adamant against torture. I mean, he's been torturing himself in war. You think he'd be the first one to be declared on someone else as a form of revenge, but it's the complete opposite. I mean,
Francisco, your phone's cutting in and out.
Oh, sorry, can you hear me better now?
Yeah, much better.
Okay, yeah, I was just explaining just the situation, how McCain was against torture, and it's kind of the same situation with you're saying how people who have engaged in war are most pro-adamant for it. So I kind of see that.
It's true. You know what? Do you know who Jesse Ventura is? He used to... I think he was the governor of, might have been Michigan, where Steve R. Culler was coming from. Anyway, Jesse Ventura used to be a wrestler. I didn't know this. I just saw him on Larry King. He was a Navy SEAL. And apparently, in order to get his credentials as a Navy SEAL, he had to undergo waterboarding. And it was really interesting because he said it's absolutely positively torture. It's horrible. And the person who was interviewing him was saying, ah, come on, you knew you weren't going to die. And he says, I knew no such thing. He says, there are all kinds of things that could have gone wrong. I could have swallowed my own tongue. It was horrific and it was horrible and it's definitely torture. And then he was saying, you know, he said, Dick Cheney's never seen combat. He said, you know, you could waterboard him and have him confess to the Sharon Tate murders. So his idea being it was completely useless information that you're going to get. But I thought that was an interesting observation because he also had contempt for somebody who's making this decision about what constitutes violence and what isn't violence, what is torture, what isn't torture, who's never actually been there. Never actually been there, and he had. And he's like, yeah, I know it's torture, and it should be illegal.
Right. And it's interesting how you're mentioning how we wouldn't want to see us go through a calamity for us to go more towards liberalism. But for instance, I kind of see society as kind of a teenager. No matter how much you try to educate and tell them to do the right things and kind of just bounces off the head, and you have to experience it firsthand to really kind of learn it firsthand. Sad to say, but that's kind of almost the only way for societies really live. So until we have something, some social pressure, to really change away from that, it's gonna stay stagnant. So it's sad,
well,
but if.
I take a more positive, you know, but I have to or I'd go crazy. That's why I'm trying to educate, you know, and I'm not the only one. There are lots of other people who are trying to shift the paradigm and create a more positive, peaceful planet. Because we don't want to have, you know, 1 in 100 citizens behind bars.
Right.
And we don't want to have the highest murder rate of, you know, of Western advanced civilizations. Nor do we want to have the highest teen pregnancy rate. Which, I mean, it's our, right now, a lot of our stats are quite dismal, and I think a lot of it plays back to this negative attitude towards sexuality, towards gender.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a bit of a leap for a lot of people, but again, you know, if you have all this pent-up sexual drive that you are not allowing yourself to be a normal sexual human being, it tends to lead to being an irritable, potentially violent human being. It just seems like those.
Well, the evidence of that is evident everywhere, and throughout history. Some of the most conservative, sexually repressive societies become the most authoritarian, pro-war, and having the most violence in their societies. From going from Sparta to modern fundamentalist radical Islam, that's why myself, like I see myself, that's why I want to become a university professor and engage in these things because I want to be an educator like yourself and teach it, and hopefully lead to a peaceful world because someone needs to speak reason in the sea of nonsense sometimes.
Awesome. And you know what? That is a really positive, upbeat note for us to stop on tonight. We're out of time. But Francisco, I love that. And, of course, you know I'm applauding you every step of the way. And I hope this was fun for you. I really enjoyed the format of having multiple callers. So maybe we can do this again a little sooner because you and I haven't been talking but about every 3 weeks. But if you're game for it, I'll give you a heads up as soon as I figure out who my next guests are. Maybe we can kind of do a multiple caller thing and discuss this a little further in a week or two.
That sounds great.
Cool.
I enjoy the conversations and I learn a lot, so I think it's good. I'll enjoy it.
Awesome. Well, you bring a lot of great information my way too, so I learn a lot too.
Okay, hopefully we keep it going.
All right, I look forward to it, and I'll talk to you in a few weeks, and thanks so much for calling in and joining me in the Shame Free Zone.
I appreciate it again. Have a nice night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me.